The latest edition of the online Issues Etc. journal is out. It contains an article that I've written titled The Theology of Jesus. What's the connection between the Church's Confession of Christ and her Confession of the Trinity? Find out with the latest Issues Etc. journal. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Pastor Mason Beecroft writes about the false promises of Pop American Christianity. Get your copy of the latest Issues Etc. journal by sending your name and email address to journal@issuesetc.org.
If we're going to have a serious debate on when a fetus becomes a human being, to bring the race element in, like because of someone's race, they should be therefore automatically on one side, I think is divisive.
Scientifically, biologically, that child in the womb at the moment of conception is a human being.
Our troops come from every corner of this country. They're black, white, Latino, Asian, Native American. They are Christian and Hindu, Jewish and Muslim. And yes, we know that some of them are gay.
You must now give yourself to Christ. That's law. And the law cannot produce spiritually good works.
I'm Daniel Berquist. I'm from Lincoln, Nebraska, and I'm a Macintosh software engineer. And I love Issues Etc.
Well, in the course of our series on the Crusades, we have learned that it was not simply a few years of the church making war along with civil government against Islam, sometimes against itself and against other enemies, but it was in fact a centuries-long endeavor that had a disparate political aim, was often misguided or even allowed itself to be misdirected. We've come to the end of our series on the Crusades. We're going to be talking about the 13th century Crusades and none other than the real St. Louis, for which the city just across the river from where I'm sitting right now is named. Dr. Matt Phillips joins us to conclude our series on the Crusades. I'm Todd Wilkin. Greetings and welcome. This is Issues Etc. Thanks for tuning us in. Our call-in number for the next hour, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org. This conclusion of the series is a great time to submit your questions and comments on the Crusades of a general nature. Talkback@issuesetc.org. Send us a tweet at @issuesetc, or you can go to our Facebook fan page and you can vote for Soundbite of the Week. We'll be playing Soundbite of the Week in about 35 minutes here on Issues Etc. Facebook.com/issuesetc. We've assembled 4 soundbites for you to listen to, and then you get to vote for Soundbite of the Week. 1-877-623-MYIE, talkback@issuesetc.org, or our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. Dr. Matt Phillips is Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Nebraska. Welcome back.
Good to be back.
You have stated several times in the course of our series with you on the Crusades that with each passing century, the Crusades become more and more entrenched, institutionalized in the life of the church itself. How so?
Well, we kind of talked a little bit about that yesterday. In the 13th century, really with the pontificate of Innocent III, he wants the recruiting for the Crusade and the basically the way the Crusade is organized and then paid for to be more sufficient and administered better, because that will allow armies to be supplied better and organization to be better, and thus the idea was to be more successful. It was also a way to get support in the minds of people all the time. As I said, the crusade themes became common in certain parts of the church year, particularly those parts of the church here dealing with the cross or the sufferings of Christ. So that those would be crusade themes that would show up in sermons and in the liturgy. There were prayers set and litany set, often like in Lent and other times, for the Holy Land, for the recovery of Jerusalem, etc. And in the 13th century, you also have, with the rise of two important religious orders in the 13th century, the Franciscans and the Dominicans, that in some ways arise and have connections to the Crusades. Dominic founds the Dominicans in southern France in response to the heresy we were talking about yesterday. And the Dominicans from early on are basically a religious order that preaches against heresy and tries to convert people, and then they become also a big part of what the first manifestations of what's known as the Inquisitions, and a lot of that was aimed at heresy too. The Franciscans and Dominicans then get recruited by popes in the 13th and 14th century to be the main crusade preachers and recruiters for various crusade projects also. So there is definitely a connection there.
And you've also mentioned many times the theological connection with the teaching on indulgences, the Pope's,
right.
the Pope's ability to grant them, the Church's yes. ability to deal with them. How is it intertwined historically with the Crusades?
Okay, that's a good question. The indulgence by the early 13th century looks a lot more like what we would think of the type of indulgence when you think of the Reformation, the early Reformation period, the type of indulgence that Luther was concerned about. It has become more of a mature doctrine, I guess we'd say. The idea that what the indulgence is by the early 13th century, kind of the idea that's been hammered out by the theologians in the late 12th century, is the indulgence deals with the temporal penalty of sin, right? You confess your sins to a priest, you're contrite for them, he absolves you of your sins, and that deals with the eternal penalty. I mean, you're not going to hell then for those sins now, because Christ has died for them. But you still have the temporal penalty, and then you must then work out that temporal penalty through deeds of satisfaction. That's the act of satisfaction. Now, we've all seen in the movie where the priest has the kid in the confessional for the first time, and he tells him, you know, I did these things, so he tells him to go do a couple of Our Fathers and whatever, and that's their satisfaction. In this case, the crusade or a pilgrimage would be the satisfaction. And it would be a big satisfaction, obviously. Purgatory also, as a doctrine, is much more well-defined by the 13th and 14th century. People understand that they believed that most people, unless they were really pious, are going to spend some time in purgatory, their soul will. All those people will eventually go to heaven, but they have to go to purgatory for a time to be purged of that temporal penalty, to make up for that temporal penalty. So the more time you spend getting indulgences or receiving indulgences, the more purgatory time's taken off, okay? So it's much more developed by the 13th century, and crusade preachers mention the indulgence and talk about losing time in purgatory and how important the crusades is from a spiritual standpoint.
So we come to St. Louis, who, you know, today St. Louis is a city,
right?
On the old western frontier with its
Correct.
Arch and its river. The real St. Louis in the 13th century. Who is this man?
Well, he was Louis the Ninth. He was the king of France. He was born in 1214. His father was the king Louis the Eighth. There's a lot of Louis in French history. We have already talked about his grandfather. His grandfather was Philip II Augustus, who went on the Third Crusade, okay? Philip II came back from the Third Crusade and lived a long time. He lived up until about he was alive when Louis was born, and actually he lived to 1223, and he established a very strong base for a stronger French monarchy. Louis VIII only rules for 3 years, and then he dies. And so Louis the Ninth, the person we know as St. Louis, is 12 when his father dies, and he is crowned king of France. But most 12-year-olds can't rule as king. His mother, a very important player in his life, her name was Blanche of Castile. So she was from the Spanish-speaking kingdom, Christian kingdom of Castile in Spain. She will basically be his regent and rule for him until he's to his early to mid-20s, which was a common practice for a young man who couldn't rule in his teenage years. She's also, even after he comes into his own as king in the 1230s, and he lives till 1270, so he lives quite a long time. He has a very long reign. She's a big influence on his life, and in some ways even a meddlesome influence, probably, until she dies in 1252. So, he's also considered not just the crusade part, but he is canonized as a saint in 1297 by Boniface VIII. It's because of he was considered one of the most pious, one of the kings that had the most integrity. He went out of his way to try to limit warfare in France between the different barons and nobles. He willed a lot. He used his power for good in many ways. in that way try to limit war, internecine war in France. He was very pious. I mean, this man would have prayed a lot. He would have gone to Mass probably every day, which wasn't uncommon for many kings at that time. He built one of the greatest chapels in history that's still in Paris called Saint-Chapelle, Holy Chapel. And he bought numerous relics at great expense from Constantinople at the time. Some of the most famous relics of Constantinople, he bought them and brought them to Saint-Chapelle in Paris. It's a beautiful, I've seen pictures of it. I've never had the good fortune to see it personally, but it's a beautiful stained glass pictures and so forth. It was a beautiful chapel. So these are the kind of pious acts that he was known for.
So he's canonized.
Yes,
very quickly after his death.
Yes. In fact, one of the witnesses was at the canonization process was a fellow named Jean Ville, who wrote the life of St. Louis, who knew him, who served him, and he was one of the main witnesses at the canonization process. So yes, he was incredibly respected. Even people of Europe that would consider him a quote enemy, it was hard for anyone not to respect him. You know, he was in their minds the epitome of what a true righteous Christian king was. He was also a great warrior, and he spent most of his warfare that he spent, the warfare that he thought was the only one God really called him to, was the crusade. And
let's take a break right there,
okay,
because
that's fine.
I want to talk on the other side of the break about his involvement in the crusades, this widely recognized, very pious leader, St. Louis, who really understands his role as a temporal leader, a temporal ruler, to fight on Christ's behalf, to fight on the church's behalf, not for his civil territory, but for the church in crusade. It's Friday afternoon, the 28th of January. What kind of questions or comments do you have about the crusades? Talk back at issuesetc.org. Send us a tweet at issuesetc or give us a call, 1-877-623-MYIE. 877-623-6943. In 1521, at the Diet of Worms, Martin Luther was asked to recant his writings. Luther responded, "Unless I am convinced from the sacred scriptures that I am in error, I cannot and will not recant. Here I stand. I cannot do otherwise. God help me. Amen." Will you stand with us as we proclaim these Reformation truths in the 21st century? You can take your stand by becoming a monthly or annual contributor to Issues Etc. To find out how you can become an Issues Etc. confessor, apologist, reformer, or patron, check out the donate page of our website, issuesetc.org. Just look for the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses. Help us proclaim the solas of the Reformation, Scripture, faith, grace, and Christ alone. Here we stand, Issues Etc., and you.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, on the 2011 International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights in Strasbourg, France.
The listeners to Issues Etc. already have had contact through the program with lecturers who will be in Strasbourg this next summer. Craig Parton, myself, Dr. Minuge, Angus Minuge, Adam Francisco, and these lecturers are people who have defended the faith, who know how to defend the faith, and who are marvelous communicators. And so, if a listener to this program wants to learn how to present the case for Christianity in a secular situation, the 2 weeks in the French Rhineland with us would be an absolutely ideal way to achieve this.
You can find out more about the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, July 5th through the 16th in Strasbourg, France, at apologeticsacademy.eu.
We say, and St. John Chrysostom agrees, that from the preaching of St. Paul, we can learn that the central message is that mankind is sinful, God does the saving through the cross of Christ.
There's even a better way to reduce crime. We could execute everyone who's presently in prison. Now, the question then is that the right thing to do?
I will show him, Paul, how much he must suffer for the sake of my name. Not, he's going to have his best life now. None of that. Paul's best life is behind him. What comes now is the way of suffering for Jesus' name.
What Jesus came to do is to give you, invite you, show you, wake you up, make you aware of that which you already have.
Just a taste of our sound bites that we'll be playing for you and you'll be voting on for Soundbite of the Week coming up here in about 20 minutes on Issues Etc. We're continuing our series on the Crusades, concluding it today with Dr. Matt Phillips, Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Nebraska. We're talking about St. Louis and the Crusades of the 13th century. You talked about the public perception of him. The church obviously thought highly of this man, canonized him shortly after his death, and there's very few bad things to be said about him, at least in terms of the witnesses of history. So why did this leader consider it most important to carry on crusade rather than the other kind of military endeavors that certainly would have been a part of his duty as a leader?
Well, one thing was he had a pretty stable kingdom. His mother had actually helped bring a truce or ending to one of the crusades we talked about yesterday, the Albigensian Crusade, and kind of brought much of southern France into the more control of the monarch from the north, and now her son got to benefit from that. He also had the great respect of most of the nobles of France. They just didn't want to go against what he said. He was able to impose his will in many ways and really reduce the problems at home. So that was one thing. He also helped create a better, during his reign, came about a better administration of courts, the beginning really of a more centralized court in Paris. I mean, the really early beginnings of it, but that was very important. So the reason to go on the crusade is because he's going to fight the unbeliever who is oppressing Christians. The similar reasons to what we heard from the very beginning of the crusades. His legacy is a crusade fighter. I mean, two of his, Louis the Seventh, would have been, I guess, his great-great-grandfather, maybe, and then, or maybe three great-grandfather, maybe two, I can't remember off the top of my head now, in the Second Crusade. I mean, his whole ancestry were crusaders. This was what they did. And to him, that was a pious act. This was one of the most pious acts a Christian king could do. Now, he was very much a man of his times in other ways. He did persecute what we would consider today persecute Jews in France for various reasons. They saw them as potential attackers of Christianity. He also went after usury that was sometimes associated with Jews quite a bit, the people who lent money and they were seen as corrupt. So he that was another way he helped fund crusade, but at great expense to himself and at great expense to his kingdom through taxation. The Pope allowed him to tax the churches of France to an extent to help pay for his first crusade particularly. And he spent 4 years preparing for it after he took the cross. So he was the crusade king par excellence in that sense.
How successful were the crusades that he participated in?
Well, like most crusades from the West, they weren't very military successful at all. There had been some interesting success before Louis. One of the more interesting fellows from this period, the early 13th century, the Holy Roman Emperor known as Frederick II, he had successfully gone to Jerusalem, in a way had himself crowned king of Jerusalem, and made a deal with the Muslim leaders to basically get Jerusalem back. But most of the Christians saw him as a conniving man. The Pope had actually excommunicated him during that time, and so there was as much fighting in between the Christians in the Middle East and back in the in Italy, particularly. So it really was division there. That truce about Jerusalem that Christians could go to it and technically it was still a Christian city for a time after Frederick ended in 1244 and it was taken back by Muslim fighters, and so that's what instigates Louis' crusade. You still had the issue of Egypt, which was the most powerful force, the rulers of Egypt, which still controlled basically Jerusalem now. And so basically it was similar to what we talked about with the Fifth Crusade. It was a similar plan from a generation before. Louis led this huge army that was a vast basically invasion force. They sailed from northern Italy and southern France, lands in the Nile Delta. They're at first pretty successful. They take one city called Damietta in the Delta, and then they ultimately, Louis actually gets captured and is in basically held prisoner for many years until he's ransomed at great expense. He ends up spending 6 years altogether away from his home. They send letters back and forth. His mother is the regent while he's gone. She actually dies while he's gone, so, I mean, he didn't see her for the last 4 or 5 years of her life. And he even stays on later, even after he's been ransomed and they know, you know, we're not going to take this back. He decides to go up to the other parts, like Acre and Tyre and these places, and try to help those Christians, and he helps rebuild some cities and so forth. So he went above and beyond. That's really the image of him, above and beyond of anyone. So that was his first crusade, and his later crusade he actually dies on when he's a much older man in 1270. They essentially go to North Africa, and they're going to go to North Africa to what today is Tunisia. They're going to march across North Africa to Egypt, and he dies fairly early on in that crusade of disease. He does not die in battle, but he dies of disease on that crusade. So that ends his life there.
Is that crusade also in response to Muslim expansion into formerly Christian territories?
Pretty much. I mean, the goal still is Jerusalem there. You also had, I mean, we'd have to go into a lot more, but you also had the arrival of the Mongols during the 13th century. And it's interesting, you know, if you could read it more deeply, you'll have Muslims fighting each other, and sometimes the different Christian factions ally with different Muslim factions against each other. So it gets very complex in the Middle East. Ultimately, what happens in the 13th century, by the late 1200s, because of various factors, a lot of it infighting among Christians, and the power of certain Muslim groups, the Mongols come in the north, and then the power of the Egyptian, what's known as then the Mamluk dynasty in Egypt, pretty much just drives them out. And the last crusader state, essentially what they're called, in the Middle East that were founded, is gone by the early 1290s. You still have Cyprus as an island state well into the 14th century, but pretty much the main crusader territories that were carved out from the first crusader pretty much gone by the late 1290s.
In that vein, Joseph in Sussex, Wisconsin, kind of wants the recap, the summary. He says, could you recap why the crusades were started and who ended them?
Well, that's a good question. Well, we kind of talked about why they were started on the first day. He'd go back and listen on Monday. Basically, they were started militarily as a defensive war to stop Muslim aggression, to protect, from the Christian perspective, of course, from the Western perspective, to stop Muslim aggression, to retake Jerusalem, to make the way open for Christian pilgrims to go to Jerusalem, defend the Eastern Church. So that's basically why it started. As we've seen, you know, over hundreds of years, things change, political machinations change. I think they end because of the forces from the West just aren't able to keep up with the fight in the East. They aren't able to support it. They aren't able to, they're too distracted by their own issues going back in Europe and in the Western Mediterranean. And they're not able to. They're just not able to fight against the Eastern powers, whether it be the Mongols, the Turks, or a combination of those groups.
Kelly says, "What would the world be like today if the Western Church had heeded the Eastern Church's pleas for help sooner? Could we have saved our Byzantine brothers from the Muslim invaders?" What are your thoughts there?
Well, I'm not sure what they mean by heeding them sooner. I mean, I guess if the When the Muslims first invade out of Arabia in the 7th century, the Western powers are in no condition at all to help. I mean, the Western Roman Empire was in tatters by that time. So I think they respond pretty early. I mean, the First Crusade is a direct response to a request by the Byzantine Emperor. There were ideas about 20 years before that, a pope named Gregory VIII, who was a pretty important pope in the 11th century, had ideas of actually leading an army himself. But I'm not sure I'd agree with the premise in the sense that I think they actually responded pretty quickly and probably sent more troops than the Byzantine Emperor actually expected, and probably at first, with the First Crusade, they were more successful than anybody expected. But the problem with the Byzantines and the Western Church, politically and somewhat theologically at that time, they weren't united, but it was more politically, I think. There was so much disunity between them that they would end up fighting each other, playing each other against the other side, and so forth.
When we come back from this break, we got a few more minutes with Dr. Matt Phillips, concluding our series, our five-part daily series on the Crusades. We're talking about St. Louis and the Crusaders in the 13th century. Dr. Phillips is Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Nebraska. The question that I think still remains to be answered, when did the church finally, even with the Crusades behind them, finally begin to make the distinction between church and state? When we hear this history, it often sounds as though one of the things that the Christian church at the time had in common with the Muslim world at the time was a failure to distinguish between this temporal power and the churchly power. When did the church begin to make that distinction in such a way, that theological distinction, in such a way that, well, to us today as Christians, we find something like the Crusades, church-led military conquests, church-called-for military conquests, unthinkable. It's a very different mindset today. We'll answer that question with Dr. Matt Phillips after this.
Are you looking for a church where you can receive the gifts of God in the gospel and the sacraments and in the church's historic worship with lively music? Then come to Hope Lutheran Church in South St. Louis. We're located on the corner of Brannan and Neosho Streets at 5218 Neosho. You can also reach us on the World Wide Web at www.hopelutheranstl.org and give us a call at 314-352-0014. There is hope in St. Louis.
Pop spirituality teaches you to look inside yourself. True spirituality teaches you to look outside yourself to the person and work of Jesus Christ. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January is titled Lutheran Spirituality, Life as God's Child. You can purchase Lutheran Spirituality by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040, or you can browse before you buy at our website issuesetc.org, Lutheran Spirituality.
Others talk. We have something to say. You're listening to Issues Etc.
British feminist calls abortion the lesser evil.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
British feminist Antonia Senior affirms that an unborn child at any stage is a human life. But then her comments take a chilling turn. Abortion, she says, is a lesser evil compared to undermining women's reproductive rights. Exhibiting transparency rarely found among abortion advocates, she argues that feminists should just admit that abortion is the killing of an unborn human, but that it is a price they are willing to pay in the name of women's rights. In her words, if you are willing to die for a cause, you must be prepared to kill for it too.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're concluding our series on the Crusades. Dr. Matt Phillips is our guest. Dr. Phillips, with about a minute and a half, when did the church begin to make the distinction between church and state so that by today we look back on this history and it seems rather odd to us that they failed to make that fundamental distinction and that, you know, today a pope calling for a war or any church leader calling for a war or being able to assemble an army or have this kind of influence seems unthinkable to us?
Well, that's a great question. It's kind of a big question too, but I'll do my best. I would say that the Enlightenment period had as much to do with the development in the West, in Western Europe, and then what becomes the United States, the Western world, has as much to do with developing the notion that that we have a, quote, separation of church and state. Now, certainly you could point to parts of the Reformation, but even in the Lutheran Reformation, as we know, the leaders of the state certainly had a lot to do with implementing Reformation. Now, they wouldn't have called for a war necessarily, but that didn't mean that Christian rulers didn't fight a war. There's definitely a theological distinction between Lutheran and Catholic there, to where, as I said before a couple of days ago, Luther said there's no problem with fighting the Turk, and God might even command it as self-defense, but we don't receive any spiritual benefits for it or anything like that. So maybe you could, there could be a case made for Luther's Two Kingdoms doctrine, but even with Luther's Two Kingdoms doctrine, he talks about the left-hand kingdom. That's also the God's rules, the left-hand kingdom, but he does it through the law and through the state. And then the right-hand kingdom is the church ruled by the gospel, through the preaching of the word and the administration of the sacrament. So I guess we could kind of see it there from our perspective as Lutherans. But I would say there's a real political divide where there's a huge cultural shift. Really doesn't happen until the Enlightenment with the 17th and 18th century, because there are technically crusades where people receive indulgences to fight against Turks in the 16th century. Maybe some would even argue after that, but the Turks are still fighting and attacking Europe well into the 17th century. So, and from the Catholic perspective, a pope could still give an indulgence or a spiritual benefit for fighting for that. I don't think you'd see much of that after the Enlightenment period, meaning, after the mid-1700s. At least I can't think of anything like that. But there might be parallels in some cases. We talk about liberation theology sometimes, a parallel that's brought up, a modern parallel, although in many ways the Catholic Church has rejected that. But think of other, like some kind of quasi-righteous causes. I can't think of any top of my head, but where we attach so much meaning to something. We're not just fighting for material things. We're fighting for God, or we're fighting for our rights or democracy or something. Although that's not religion, it's more of an ideology than it is a fighting for land or material. So I think that I would have to say the Enlightenment period is really where that begins to change, at least in the West.
Folks, if you've enjoyed our 5-part series on the Crusades, please consider making a tax-deductible gift to support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. You can make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support. Dr. Matt Phillips is Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Nebraska. Matt, thanks for all your time during this series on the Crusades.
It was fun. Thank you.